Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, the director of the Huff Finds Institute. And before we get to the podcast, I wanted to remind you that coming up soon on November the 20th from 1 to 4 p.m. is the annual Huff Finds discussion. This is our fifth iteration of this great event. We have got some fabulous speakers lined up for you. Go on the website, look at who's coming, and be here. Either be here or be at one of the satellite sites that we list on the website to catch it. Otherwise, you'll wait till January and we'll be putting the videos up at that point. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so glad that you took the time to join us this week. Every week we bring you another interesting individual, the world of sports medicine and human performance, and this week is no exception. We are pleased to have with us today Dr. Jose Bermudez from here at Texas A&M. Welcome to the podcast, Jose.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're very happy to have you. We're going to tell the audience a little bit about you and why you're here, and then we'll just jump into our conversation, huh?
Sounds good.
So Dr. Bermudez originally got his master's degree and a doctorate in philosophy from King's College at Cambridge University. Dr. Bermudez spent some time at Washington University as the director of philosophy, neuroscience, psychology program. He then moved to Texas A&M, where he was the dean of the College of Liberal Arts. He became the associate provost for strategic planning, and now he's a professor of philosophy.
Once again,
and enjoying life as it is, right?
Exactly right.
But we're really not here to talk to him today about all those wonderful things. We're really here to talk to him about one of his wonderful accomplishments recently. Dr. Bermudez is one of the elite long-distance bicyclists in the world.
It's a small community, so it's not hard to be in the elite.
So this summer, we're going to talk about this. This summer, he competed in and completed the Race Across America. And for those of you that aren't familiar with the Race Across America, it was in its 34th year this year. That's where you ride for about 3,000 miles. This year is 3,004 miles, I think, from Oceanside, California to Annapolis, Maryland, as fast as you can. And it is a race, right?
That's right. It's a race. The clock starts in Oceanside and stops in Annapolis. What you do in between is your business, but the clock doesn't stop.
Doesn't stop for sleeping or eating or anything?
Absolutely not.
No. Now, there is you went as a solo. They do allow teams to run in this.
You can do it as a team of two, a team of four, a team of eight, but I think a lot of people think the real race is in the solo division.
The glamour is in the solo division.
I don't know whether it's glamour, but it's there's a lot of excitement there.
Well, now this again, I want the audience to remember this is a little bit over 3,000 miles. They actually have a limit. The solo, you guys have to finish it in 12 days.
You finish it in 12 days or under. You have an extra 21 hours if you're female or if you're over the age of 60.
And so this year you finished. We'll talk about 2013 a little bit later on, but this year you finished, and tell everybody how you did.
I did okay. I came 12th out of 27 starters, and finishing time 11 days, 16 hours, 53 minutes. So comfortably inside the 12 day limit.
Now, I want everybody listening to think about that. And that was 3,000 miles on a bicycle in a little bit under 12 days, about 8 hours under 12 days. That's an amazing accomplishment.
I think one way to think about it is just kind of think about what you were doing 12 days ago and just imagine that in all that intervening time when you've been going to work, enjoying yourself and sleeping and eating and stuff, you were just basically on a bike all day, every day, except for 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Wow.
Each 24-hour period.
So every 24 hours, you're only off the bike for 2 hours and 15 minutes. What was happening during that 2 hours and 15 minutes?
Well, it was really structured. I had a support team of nine people. They worked in shifts. And one of the things that they did was make sure I had a really, really productive time off the bike. So we spent those 2 hours, 15 minutes with a stopwatch. So the first 15 minutes I spent eating, typically a pasta or something like that. Then 15 minutes, a quick massage, a shower, 90 minutes sleep, and then 15 minutes eating again, and then back on the bike.
Wow. So it's been estimated that in a race like this that an athlete is taking in over 8,000 calories a day when they're riding.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you've got to look at is not so much what you're taking in, but what you're burning up. And if there's a mismatch between those, then you get in terrible trouble. I mean, you can run a marathon and get in the hole at mile 15 and you'll probably finish. You can do a 200-mile race and get in a hole at mile 150 and you'll probably finish. But you can't get in a hole at day four of a 12-day race and finish.
Right, right.
So, yeah, you're burning up about 8,000 to 10,000 calories a day, and you need to take those in.
Right. And this week, your podcast is following a podcast we had on last week by a lady named Kathy Langlotz, a local lady who rode across America. But it was a tour, basically. And, you know, they took their time. They did it over 3 months. The difference here, this is an absolute race. This is who gets from one side of the country to the other.
Yeah, and I think that raises, especially from a nutrition point of view, that raises some real challenges. Because you have to think about the topography.
Mm.
So you start in Oceanside, California. You climb out over the coastal range mountains. They're pretty steep.
Mm-hmm.
You go up to about 5,000 feet on Mount Palomar. Then you drop right down into the Anza Borrego Desert, which is a real desert.
Desert.
And when we went through, it was about 120 degrees in the day. I mean, they were having a heat wave.
Mm.
So just thinking about how you take in the food when it's 120 degrees, when you're on your bike, when you're kind of feeling dizzy and dehydrated, and the last thing you want to do is eat, but you've still got to find a way of getting 8,000 calories into you. It's really kind of, it's challenging.
Right. And this race is always in the summer. So this is not like this happened in January when it's cool.
That's another piece of the topography. It happens in June because that's pretty much the earliest time that you can be guaranteed that the passes over the Rockies won't be snow covered.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the other piece of the topography. You're climbing up to nearly 11,000 feet three times going over the Rockies. So you deal with altitude sickness and those kind of issues, which also don't really make you want to eat massively either.
So how do you train for something like that? Let's just jump into the training part. How do you train for this? I know you do other long bike rides, and you have to qualify to be in the solo category. Do you go out and ride a certain distance every day, or do you build up over 2 years for this?
Well, there's really two pieces to the training. I mean, obviously, you've got to train your body to do the distance.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go out and ride a 3,000-mile race, but you can do shorter races. So in the year before, I did several 500-mile races, 24-hour races.
Sorry, I'm laughing. Shorter is a relative term in this case.
Shorter than 3,000, but long by most standards. So there are Texas is pretty well stocked with ultra bike races. So I did a couple of 500-mile races and a couple of 24-hour races and a 1,000-mile race.
You won several of those.
I won several of them, yeah. I came third in the 1,000-mile race, won a couple of the 24s, and won one of the 500s.
Amazing.
But again, it's not a big field. But it's true that people don't show up unless they're serious.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have to be serious.
So that's one part of the training. And then the other part is really much more thinking about your lactate threshold.
Mm.
I mean, what's important on a 3,000-mile race is your average speed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really the power output that you can average, or the percentage of your maximum power output that you can average. So you want your threshold, your lactate threshold, to be as high as possible, so that when you're going along at your endurance pace, you're covering as many miles as possible in the hour. I mean, it's basically as simple as that.
Yeah, and you move that lactate threshold through intensity training and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it. Everyone knows you can do it one of two ways. You can either train just below your threshold and push it up, or you can train above it with VO2 maximum intervals and pull it up and do both of those.
Yeah, intervals are always fun to do.
Intervals are fun.
They both said sarcastically.
So I spend a lot of time doing that. I've got a coach who works with me on periodization and making sure that I was peaking in time for the race.
Now, when did you decide that you wanted to do this? This is obviously something that you can't do at the drop of a hat.
No, I moved to Texas in 2010 to come to A&M to be dean. And I used to live in St. Louis. And in St. Louis, we had a great bike racing scene. Mm. I could race my bike three or four times a week without driving more than an hour. We raced two races every Tuesday night, have races, road races on Saturday and Sunday. And in the summer and in winter, we'd have cyclocross races or mountain bike races. But then College Station, Texas, that wasn't available.
Right.
And as dean, I didn't have a huge amount of time to travel to Houston or Austin to get on the racing circuit. So I figured that the would be more effective way of racing would be to do a small number of long events and then to work my training around that. So I started doing that in about 2010. Mm. And I did the first part of the Race Across America, which goes from Oceanside to Durango. It's a separate race called the Race Across the West, and I did that in 2011.
Hmm. I guess then to follow up on that, so have you always been a cyclist? Has this always been your...
No. My sport used to be high-altitude mountaineering and rock climbing and ice climbing and alpine climbing. But when I moved to St. Louis, that wasn't really available there.
Unless you're going to climb the arch or something.
Unless you wanted to climb buildings.
Yeah.
So then I moved to originally to mountain bike racing and then to road racing.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because on the Race Across America website, they do a lot of comparisons between mountaineering and this Race Across America and how they're different, but yet they're both very extreme forms
of
activity.
Yeah, I think certainly with high-altitude mountaineering, when you just above an acceptable oxygen levels or below acceptable oxygen levels for long periods of time, if you're climbing an 8,000-meter peak without oxygen, for example, it's a kind of similar bodily experience because what you're doing is basically fighting decay. I mean, there's no way that you can keep your body at normal levels of functioning or nutritional hydration because you're just managing the deterioration. And it's the same in the Race Across America. Mm. You want to get to the finish line not with so much left that you could have gone much quicker, but you don't want to be crawling across like a zombie as many people do.
Right. You don't want to go across the line thinking, man, I could do another 3,000 miles.
No, you don't want to do that, but you don't want to never want to get on your bike again either.
Yeah. So what's it like to only have 90 minutes of sleep? Is that something you train for? Or is that something you just take as it comes?
You know, I think that's the hardest thing. Mm. I mean, the physical effort is, you know, you can do it. I think if you're tough enough and you're well trained enough. But managing without sleep is pretty challenging.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, then rode off the road once, just falling asleep, just and going pretty fast in Kansas, going down a hill, just fell asleep, woke up and, you know, rolled cartwheeling down a hill, heading for a concrete drainage ditch. And nothing was broken. My bike was broken, but I was fine. And that's a kind of constant thing. I mean, you're just constantly falling asleep and you've got to force yourself to keep awake. It's just incredibly difficult. It's a constant battle.
Did you normally, when you took your 2 hours and 15-minute break, did you do that at night or did you do that?
Just did it at 24-hour intervals.
24-hour intervals.
Right. And obviously the 24 hours was a little bit elastic. So sometimes it ended up being 3 in the morning, sometimes midnight, sometimes 6 in the morning.
So most of the time you were riding through the night though.
Yeah, and that's nice in lots of ways. It's sort of peaceful. There's less traffic.
Yeah.
You can kind of get in the zone because it's just a little pool of light and you're riding in the little pool of light from the support vehicle headlights.
So, and we'll come back to the support vehicles in a minute, but I guess that brings up a question, that is that these are on normal roads. I mean, they don't close the traffic off.
These are normal roads, and actually going through Missouri, the race takes Highway 50.
Hmm.
If you've been to Missouri, you'll know that Highway 50 is a pretty big road as it goes past Osage Beach and some of the lakes down in southwest Missouri. So it's 6 lanes of traffic, and you're on the shoulder, but if you think about riding a bicycle along the shoulder, and you think about traffic coming on at 75 miles an hour and how you get across those exit ramps and entrance ramps safely, it's kind of a challenge when you're dealing with sort of sleep deprivation and all those other issues.
Wow. And we mentioned this, we talked about this a little bit beforehand. There are accidents that happen, bike and car accidents that happen during this race.
Yeah, I think first let me just give you some numbers on just the total number of people. So I think that I was the 260th person who's finished this race in 34 years.
Right.
The overall success rate among solo racers is around about 50%.
Mm. And that's amazing. I mean, it's a small club.
It's a really small club. I mean, more people climb Everest every year than have finished the Race Across America in its entire lifetime. And, you know, bazillions times more complete an Ironman or other things like that. So, in the course of the race, I mean, there have been several fatalities.
Mm.
Every year there's people end up, as I did in 2013, hospitalized with kidney failure or dehydration issues. Pneumonia is a pretty common problem that people get as they go up into the Rockies.
Really?
It's sort of a combination of thin air, complete exhaustion, and moisture in the lungs and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then people get hit by cars. Mm. So we had one person got hit by a motorbike this year on his ninth running of the race. One guy got hit by a car and he's still in a coma. So there's really quite a lot of ways in which things can go wrong and riding your bike nonstop across the country.
Now, you do have a support crew, and it's your responsibility to have your support crew. The race does not provide that.
No, you provide your own support crew, and it's kind of hard to put one together.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is how you put that, because you have 9 people.
Yeah, I was fortunate to have 9 people that were interested and excited to do this. And the way we organized it was with 2 minivans, and actually we had 3 minivans, one of them provided by a local bike shop, Aggieland Cycling, two that I hired from a rental company. And there was always one minivan riding behind me with two or three people in it. One minivan with the crew that was off duty. They did 12-hour shifts, so when they're 12 hours off, they'd get some sleep and then have to drive up the road to catch up with us. And one crew that was just basically doing laundry and shopping and logistics and trying to figure out where other races were and stuff like that.
So you actually had somebody saying, oh, you're 5 hours behind the next person?
Yeah, and that's the right sort of distance. I mean, a photo finish in RAM is sort of finishing within an hour of the next person.
Wow. And so these people just volunteered. Are these people that
some
you
knew? Some of them
knew?
I knew from College Station. Some were bike racers. I found a physiotherapist in Singapore who was really interested in crewing, and she came. I flew her over. I had a bike mechanic from our local bike shop, Aggieland Cycling, a nurse who I knew vaguely through bike racing, and then just some general bike enthusiast people. And it's tough. I mean, riding in a vehicle that not very many miles an hour for 12-hour shifts and then sleeping and then doing it again for 12 days is hard work.
Yeah. Well, we call it
But they keep you safe.
Don't we call it an adventure, right?
We call it an adventure, but they figure out pretty quick it's not an adventure.
So how many more repeats from your 2013 effort?
I think only one.
Only one?
Yeah, I was a student here at A&M.
Yeah. So let's talk about 2013. This is the 2015 is not the first time that you attempted the race.
No, 2013 I tried it. A much smaller crew. We had only six people. Got into a real mess in the desert. Hospitalized for 12 hours, kidney failure, really bad dehydration. I got back on the bike and caught up. The race has cutoff points. You have to make the time cut at Durango and then again at the Mississippi. Otherwise, you get thrown out. So I managed to get back on track in Durango. But one real problem that ultra-endurance cyclists have is something called Schirmer's neck. When you lose control of all the muscles in your neck, so you can't hold your head up.
Wow.
And you get there when you're in a hunched up position over a bicycle for 22 hours a day. So I got that in Kansas, and I had to put my neck in a neck brace and holding my head up. Rode like that for 500 miles and then...
Oh, so you did ride like that for 500 miles? Oh, my. Wow.
Call it a day in Kansas.
Yeah. Your mind, how do you tell your mind that you're going to continue to race even though your brain is probably telling you that you need to stop? That's where your doctorate in philosophy comes into play.
Basically, my experience of all these long-distance events is they're all the same.
Yeah.
In the following sense, you start out, you ride for whatever. If it's a 200-mile race, it's probably the first 70 miles. If it's a 500-mile race, it'll be the first 180. If it's a 3,000-mile race, it's probably about the first 800. And then you go through this initial period, this euphoria, it's exciting. You're heading fast, and then finally you get to a point where you think, holy moly, I've done 800 miles. I've got 2,200 miles left to go. It's inconceivable. That's almost three times as much as I've already done, you know, days and days of torture ahead. How on earth is I going to manage this?
Yeah.
And then you've just got to get through that. And the only way to get through it is to just break it down into the next hill, the next time station, the next meal, the next Coke, whatever, just a series of small little steps. And that's the way that I found I can make these huge, almost unimaginable distances manageable. Because if you think last time you flew across the country,
right,
how long it took you to get from the East Coast to just even to Kansas, let alone to California, and you think about that on a bike.
And you get off the plane and you're worn out as it is. Yeah. You can't imagine doing
you
it
have
on
to,
a bike.
You have to break it down into manageable.
Yeah.
Size chunks.
So are you done? You're not done with endurance
racing?
No,
I'm not done with endurance racing. It's pretty good fun. I got to Annapolis, you know, tired, but I could have gone on. And that was deliberate. We raced a pretty conservative race. And I think we could save time. I could save probably lose those 16 hours and get in under 11 days. And that's what I'm going to try and do in 2017. There are other races in between now and then.
Well, and I wanted to make the point is you're not doing this just for yourself. You have a big charitable arm of your efforts.
Yeah, I raised money both in 2013 and 2015 for our local chapter of Habitat for Humanity. And that's really satisfying to raise money for a pretty worthwhile, extremely worthwhile cause. In fact, we succeeded in building a new house in 2013, another one again in 2015. 2015. So there's two families that have got homes that wouldn't otherwise have homes.
Congratulations.
All I did was ride the bike. Other people provided the support and donated the money. But I did pay for the race myself, and all the funds that were raised went to Habitat.
Yeah, that was the point we were going to make along the way. So all the support staff and everything, that comes out of your pocket.
Yeah, I mean, they don't get paid, but they have to be fed and housed and transported and taken to and from. And they came from all over the place. I mean, my coach came down from Alaska to support me. The physiotherapist came from Singapore. The nurse was in Missouri. And
quite
a lot
of
air miles. It's a lot of air miles.
So regular listeners of the program will know that we always give our guest an opportunity to give us a take-home message. If there's something that you want people to remember from this podcast today, what would be your take-home message?
Well, I think there are two, really, and we've kind of talked about both of them. The first one is that, you know, these huge tasks and challenges are really just the sum of lots of small ones, and that's how you need to think about them, I think, to be successful. Mm-hmm. And the second one, there's a lot of people involved behind the scenes in making these things work, and I'm just incredibly grateful to the help I had from the medical people here in College Station, from folks in health and kinesiology and the athletics department, and from my support crew.
Well, thank you for being here. It's quite an accomplishment, and we're very proud of you. That's great.
Thanks.
What we'll do is we're also going to put up your website on the show notes.
Great.
So if people want to donate for your efforts next time when you build another house,
fantastic.
They'll have that opportunity
fantastic.
To do that. So, again, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
And many of you that are regular listeners know that also at this time we have our weekly podcast question of the week. And here with our podcast question of the week is our producer, Kenneth McIntyre.
What number finisher of the Race Across America in its 34-year history was Dr. Bermudez?
Great question. Be the first one to send us the correct answer via email. Send it to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts. Again, thank you all for taking the time to download us and listen to us today. Again, thank you, Dr. Bermudez, for being with us, and good luck on the bike next time.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. And to all of you, again, once again, thank you. Please join us next week when we have another interesting person in the world of sports medicine and human performance. And until next week, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Aidlint Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.